I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A fascinating new novel just out now is the new book from the critically acclaimed Cary Sakamoto, Floating City. It's a book about an ambitious young man who grows up in Port Alberni in a floating house amongst Japanese bachelors working in the logging camps. As World War II comes, Frankie Hanasaka is interned. This experience shapes him and fuels his desire to move up. After the war, he moves to Toronto and falls in with Buckminster Fuller. I'll get Ms. Sakamoto, who joined me earlier this month while in Victoria, British Columbia, to tell us about her book, this character, and the backdrop of history and setting that this book illustrates. Cary Sakamoto's debut novel, The Electrical Field, was published in 1998, soon nominated for numerous awards, winning the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best First Book and the Canada-Japan Literary Award. Her second novel, 100 Million Hearts, was released in 2003. This new book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Cary Sakamoto. Ms. Sakamoto, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Yeah, I'm enjoying the book a great deal because, part of it is set in British Columbia, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It starts in Port Alberni, which mm-hmm. is actually where my mother was born and raised.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So let's just talk about Frankie and this part of the world where he grows up in Port Alberni. This is, I guess, just before the war, right?
Yes. It's like in the 1920s to 30s,
uh-huh.
And then it goes up until Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the evacuation of the Japanese Canadian community to Vancouver and the Peony Grounds.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so for Frankie, because he's such a remarkable person, a young man at this point. What does this do for, say, his ambition or whatever he's dreaming about?
Well, you know, from childhood, his family undergoes a series of sort of displacements. First, the land that they have initially settled on by the water in Port Alberni is expropriated, and they're very, very poor. And so what they do is they decide to just push the house out onto the water because nobody owns the water exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the sort of magical realism of the book. But also is sort of about, you know, just gumption and surviving hardship and having agency to weather misfortune.
And so the internment experience for him, what does that do for what he wants to do after it? I mean,
he's quite embittered by it, but to survive in the camp, he becomes a bit of a wheeler-dealer, black market supplier of goods for people in the camp, just supplying, you know, things like stockings or just trading what he can and bootleg sake that his mother makes. But he becomes very determined and embittered, and his ambition grows to become quite fierce and even ruthless, that he feels that he could do to others what has been done to him.
Yeah, it's a great, great's not the right word, but I mean, war and the trauma of that, I mean, it shapes not only Frankie, but it shapes generations afterwards, doesn't it? I mean, it affects so much that the those of us that think of war don't really, you know, we think of it as happening at a certain period of time and then it ends, but I mean, it doesn't really, you know?
Yeah, and I've always felt, and I think my books have been about that, the sort of the reverberations of racism and war on subsequent generations, but also just, you know, I don't think any of us are untouched by war in some way through our relatives or friends, our ancestors, and our society is affected, you know, through time and through generations. The legacies of racism and brutality are felt on on subsequent generations.
So after the war, where does the book take us in terms of Frankie's life, the trajectory of his life? I mean, because I haven't finished the book yet. Where does the book end roughly in the timeline, say?
So after the war ends and the camps are closed, the internment camps, Frankie heads east, and he makes his way to Toronto, and initially he works while the family stays behind in the camps, and he works to establish himself and to set up a family home for his parents and his new wife there in Toronto, but he encounters a lot of difficulty finding a job, and eventually he is he's taken on as a gardener, a live-in gardener for a Jewish family, and this is based on the fact that many Jewish business owners really supported Japanese right after the war. There was kind of empathy for their situation and the racism that they experienced. And so he's taken in by a man who is a very successful architect and mentors Frankie, and he's one of the key figures in his life who sort of alters the course of his life, of Frankie's life.
Yeah. And so through this all, I mean, he struggles with identity, doesn't he?
Yes, he wants to be a successful man like any other man.
Yeah.
And that sort of means in part not being Japanese, not being that enemy alien that he's been designated during the war, and trying to escape that past and that identity and still feeling like a lowly sort of outcast. And all of that feeds his ambition, and he eventually becomes a very successful real estate developer, but loses a lot in the process. So,
yeah, and it's something that he struggles with, because these things come to the fore constantly, don't they?
Yes,
I mean that's how people look at him, and even though he's trying to, you know, he's trying to get through the day to day stuff.
Yeah, so even as he begins to dress in fine clothes and build, you know, a home for his family, he still feels inadequate and marked in a way. And he becomes kind of unrecognizable to his own family. And so the book is also kind of intertwined with the history of the growth of modern-day Toronto, from it, like its architectural growth and the growth of the cityscape and building along the southern core of Toronto and the waterfront, because he's really kind of obsessed with owning that land that was taken away from him, and that view out to the water, which represents, you know, his homeland of Japan in a way, and his own homeland in Vancouver, and the sense of possibility that water and the ocean kind of represents, and Lake Ontario kind of stands in for that in a way.
And the interesting thing is, so Buckminster Fuller comes into his life, and in real life, he had a vision for the waterfront as well, right?
Yes, this is such a remarkable thing, and when I found this out, and my friend Bruce Colbera, who's a very renowned Canadian architect, he had mentioned to me just in a casual conversation that in 1970, Buckminster Fuller had been commissioned to propose a floating community in Toronto Harbour. So that was at a time when the city, the inner city, was very overcrowded, and there were all these ideas about the great influx of new immigrants at the same time as people fleeing to the suburbs looking for some other kind of better quality life and way of living. And so this was proposed actually by the industrialist John Bassett, commissioned, I should say, commissioned by him. And it was it actually went as far as being presented to city council, and there was a like a model made, a maquette, and it's just an amazing kind of magical thing that this might have happened in Toronto, but of course it didn't. So so this was very interesting to me because also Buckminster Fuller was very, his ideas were very respected in Japan, being a densely populated series of islands. So he had a business partner who was Japanese-American, an architect, and so this sort of set my, my imagination going about thinking of that person, that partner to Buckminster Fuller, perhaps being my character, Frankie. What might have happened.
What's great about your book as I'm reading it is that, that there were real-life things that I know about, situations that happened in history, and you're able to put your characters, put your situations into them, and it makes for such a richer experience for me as the reader. Is that... as you're writing it, and you say you found out about Fuller's plans, that must have been exciting for you to sit there and you know think of your own story and say you know taking elements of what happened in real life say and putting them all together.
Yes, it was. It was really exciting to do the research and kind of get to know Bucky, as he was called affectionately. He was an incredible visionary, and we know him through the American Pavilion, the geodesic dome that he built for Expo 67. And to sort of fit Frankie's own life trajectory into that historical line. And, you know, it's there's a little bit of... you know, I had to sort of take some liberties. And there, you know, because of the advent of the skyscraper in Toronto, and there was a lot of really interesting research, too, about, you know, about skyscrapers and when certain kind of building techniques became possible. And it was fascinating. I really enjoyed that part of writing the book.
Now, the character like Frankie... because you have created him, you've shaped him, and you've written his life, essentially. Is he someone that you like? I mean, like personally?
Well, what I think is that, you know, I've always believed that, you know, people who go through these experiences, these kind of experiences of racism and loss, they're not always... the most likable people. They become embittered. But I wanted to give Frankie a sense of agency to, I believed in him to overcome this kind of his bitterness. And the book is really, is about that journey for him towards embracing something more meaningful and in a positive way and light-filled and hopeful. And I hope that that's what is conveyed in the book because I think that's what, you know, that's what, you know, people who undergo these difficult situations, embittering, they're not always benign sufferers who, you know, who are saintly and
innocent.
You know, and so we have to understand that about people, I think, that to, you know, even through that dislikability, that we have to have empathy for them and, you know, appreciate what that those kinds of experiences do to people.
He's a very, very richly drawn character. Like, I mean,
there
are so many layers, and I mean, I get that sense early on in the book. Is he someone that, that you've been with for a long time? Like in terms of like, you, I hate to ask this question because I'm sure you're getting this a lot because it's been 15 years since your last book.
Yeah.
I'm not assuming that you've been taking the last 15 years to write this one, but I mean, Just how long have you spent with Frankie?
I feel like I've spent a long time with him because he's sort of a composite of people I've known.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this is my first book that I wrote from the point of view of a man. And, you know, I thought about what, you know, I tried to think about and empathize with the experience of a man at this time period. And the difficulty to, you know, of going out into the world and feeling this burden of having to, you know, be out in that public realm where you are unwanted, you know, and less than just another man, less than a fully enfranchised citizen, and how difficult it must be to go out there and to be a man, and what that sense. The sense of what a man had to be in the 1940s and 50s and 60s especially, and to be the breadwinner and to provide for your family and with dignity, and yet be subjected to experiences that were so demeaning and emasculating. And I really wanted to, you know, so that's something I thought about a lot about, you know, for the men in my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, my father, my uncles, and you know, and men I've you know in general,
mm-hmm.
that very different experience to women who were more who were facing other hardships and in who were cocooned in the domestic realm, but of course had their own hardships to face. So I feel like I've lived with this idea for a long time, I think also, you know, with I've raised two boys.
Mm-hmm.
I've thought a lot about, you know, what it is to be male and to grow up and have you know, a sense of oneself in the world. And at the same time they really tugged me out into the world of you know, another imagination and possibility and hopefulness. The future.
Yeah, and it must be, I don't know if fun is the right word, but having thought of these things for a long time and writing this book, to now bring it out into the world and get some feedback from readers, what's that been like so far? Because you have traveled, you're in Victoria where I'm talking to you today.
I've started on my, you know, doing readings, and
uh-huh.
It's been, actually, I just launched the book officially last night in Toronto, and
I
had such a wonderful time with family and friends and other supporters, and it is really special to, like, any book coming out and bringing it out into the world when you've been, you know, you've been in your little room writing at the computer and, you know, in this kind of, you know, cocoon, and suddenly you bring it out into the world. It's scary and exciting, and, you know, hope that it connects with readers.
Yeah, and I've read some of the reviews. It has, hasn't it?
I hope so.
Yeah. Oh, you don't read reviews, or?
No, I try not to,
yeah.
Because, you know, you have to keep your sense of, you know, what you were trying to do, and I certainly like talking to people about it,
uh-huh.
And, you know, but...
Yeah, I guess it's like all feedback. I mean, if you accept the good feedback, you'll have to accept the bad, even though the bad may not be...
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, yeah, and to be honest, it's always so different. It's very apart from your intentions, how people receive the book.
They read into it, right, don't they?
Yeah, and some people, if I've read really good reviews, I think, oh, well, that's interesting. Like, but that wasn't exactly what I was thinking when I was reading it.
Yeah.
And then bad reviews make you feel really bad.
Yeah,
I think it's hard not to. And so I think it's better to just, you know, try to protect yourself a little bit from that and hang on to, you know, what you know, your own feeling about the book. And, you know, I had such a positive experience with my editor. He was so supportive, and because the ideas sort of seemed disparate in the beginning, to bring together the idea of Buckminster Fuller and this story of this Japanese-Canadian family and immigrating, and he just really believed in it, Craig Payette, and at Knopf, and I just want to hold on to that good feeling.
Yeah. What? Writing is very much rewriting, as they say, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I remember when I was a student and I went to a lecture by Toni Morrison, the great Toni Morrison, and she said, if you want to write, you better start to like revising, because that's what it's all about. And, you know, really so true. And whenever if I give workshops, I really tell people that. Mm. You know, you can't be invested in everything you write coming out kind of perfect on the page. It's just a myth, you know, that's how, you know, that writing is this sort of, you know, magical thing. It's writing and rewriting, and it's never wasted. I have so much writing that I did that I threw away, but it's always making you a better writer.
Mm. Yeah. I'm interested in the habits of a writer. Is there a certain time of day when you do it, or in a certain place, say?
I write at my dining room table, and my dog sits by my side, and she's always so encouraging. So, and I love the morning, because the morning feels like you've got the day ahead. Mm. My dog says, oh yeah, that was good, Carrie. How about a steak? you need to surround yourself with people who are supportive. Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel.
What do you write on? I mean, when you're at your dining room table, is it pen and paper? Is it a computer?
It's a computer. It's absolutely a computer. I'm a really fast typist and a very slow handwriter. So I find ideas that flit into my head, I'm not fast enough in capturing them, just writing out by hand. But I do make notes. You know, like when things occur to me, I have a notebook. I always have a notebook to scribble things down. But you know how things slid into your head and observations or whatever. Yeah. Somehow you need those ruminating times. So you've got to capture those thoughts.
The revising process, is that also done at the same place where you write?
Yes, and... it depends. Sometimes I sit down with the printout. Sometimes I think, okay, I'm going to just start over. Like, not start over, but I'm going to start this section or even paragraph. I know it. It's in me, and I'm going to just rewrite it and have a fresh go at it. But, I kind of like revising, actually. It's like polishing and honing.
Yeah. And I hate to ask this because you're out promoting this book now, but I'm sure you'll be asked this wherever you go. Are you working on something new at the moment?
Yes, I am. I am. I have this other idea for a long time, and I just made little notes, and I have a little folder for it. But I think like both of my books, I started out with something that was kind of like a short story, but not a good short story, more like a short story that is a long story that can't be cut short.
Mm.
So that's what's in progress right now. Mm. It turns out to be like almost kind of like a little pricey in a way.
Uh-huh.
So.
You're in Victoria when I'm talking to you. You'll be in Vancouver shortly. But by the time this is up on the website, you'll be, are you traveling throughout the country for this book?
I've done stuff around Ontario, and I'll be doing a little bit more there too. But we'll see what comes up.
Yeah.
I'm open to things. So.
Yeah. As I said, I'm in the midst of it, and I'm enjoying it a great deal. And it's a book that a lot of people should read because there's a lot in here.
Oh, thank you.
Hopefully we've touched on some of it, but beyond that, there's more in here. Congratulations on this book, and I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Oh, well, thank you, Joseph. It's been a pleasure.
The book is called Floating City. It is published by Knopf. Its author, Kerry Sakamoto, joined me on the line from Victoria, British Columbia, earlier this month. I'm Joseph Plato.